Welcome to an all new episode of Mistweeted. So I usually start off the show with something light. This time we're going straight for it. We're gonna go for the guts and the glory. I don't know if you've noticed, but some Americans are a little bit upset. I don't know what it is. Could be inequality, discrimination, could be Trump, could be Biden, could be any number of things. I am not a psychiatrist. However, I will play one today on the internet. I put this together. Now, there are different terms that we could use for the accused or the accuser. Could be victim or perpetrator, or, you know, billionaire and 99%er, or employer or employee. So whoever you think is the powerful party and whoever you think is the low power party. Now, this is a little bit simplified, this chart, but I think it gets to the core of where we are today as a society. So let's start with feelings. When two people are really upset, tempers flare, no one's thinking clearly, and things escalate, sometimes to violence. And we've seen that. We've seen that on the streets of New York. We've seen that, you know, at rallies. We've seen that in a lot of places. We see it online every day. Both the accusers and the accused, whoever they may be, both sides are kind of culpable. You know, when you accuse someone, people take it personally, especially things they haven't done. There are a lot of ways to show differences in power dynamic, or that minorities may not always be treated fairly, certainly by the cops or other groups. But then when you throw around white privilege and other things, that's a blunt instrument. That's like Dick Cheney going hunting. He's not using a precise instrument. He is, you know, spraying those bullets and trying to get a lot of ducks. When you do that, when you use those blunt instruments, the response from the other side is typically emotional. And that's what we're seeing. Now let's talk about when the accused or the powerful party responds with facts. And I see that a lot online, you know, where people are like, well, what about this statistic? And what about this article? And what about that? Nobody cares. Because when someone feels wronged, when they feel emotional, when they feel compromised in some way, when they feel like something's been taken away from them, they're not going to sit there and look through your statistics. They're not going to sit there and listen to your rational ideas. And that's why, you know, when all of these TV shows throw statistics out there and, you know, oh, well, this scientific study showed this. Next time you're in a relationship, try this. When the other person is screaming and inflamed, tell them, calm down. And then see if the neighbors hear the rest of what happens next. And that's what's happening. A lot of the people who are coming back, they may even have a great point. There may be rational solutions here. There may be good ideas. There may be statistics that refute the emotions. But it doesn't matter because people aren't listening. Now, let's talk about a situation where the accuser acts with facts on their side, saying, look, you know, we're underrepresented, or we had this many applicants and this many were rejected, whatever it is that is fact driven, or saying, you know, in our industry, there's a pay disparity of X percent, and we looked at nearly identical groups, and there is some sort of inequality or discrimination. Now, that's much more powerful, but it's also rare in these moments. If you do go with facts, but the powerful party responds with feelings, that's a recipe for tokenism. And tokenism is when you do things that look like you're doing something, but in reality, you're not changing the guts. So I'll give you two examples. I have been seeing these ads from Goldman Sachs on Twitter. If you knew nothing about Goldman Sachs, and you only had these ads, you would think this was a nonprofit, the greatest charity ever invented on Earth, because all they talk about is diversity, inequality, and solving racial matters and all this stuff. You wouldn't even know it's a financial services company, because they all the people that are photographed on their posts are all, you know, young Black women or underrepresented groups or other things. And you would think, oh my God, this is the greatest freedom fighting organization ever invented. It's, you know, Gold Lives Matter, whatever it is that they're up to. But it is amazing. It is truly inspiring. They may be doing some good things. I don't know. I didn't do an audit. But oftentimes, when a powerful party taps into the zeitgeist of the moment, they're not giving up power. In fact, no one is ever voluntarily giving up power. It's like, oh, you know, you're underrepresented. Okay, well, just take my job. I'm leaving. I'm out. No one is going to say that. No one. And it would be silly to think otherwise. But what they will do is a lot of cosmetics. And this is very similar to what's happening in Hollywood right now, where they just announced a whole slew of criteria to get nominated for an Oscar. There has to be, you know, diversity in the staffing or casting. There has to be diverse subject matter, all these other things. I don't remember the specifics. But the idea is, hey, we, the people who run these companies, are going to keep our jobs. And we're going to still keep all of the benefits and back office power and money and all that other stuff. But to you, the people watching the Oscars, we're going to make it look like a rainbow, a beautiful, beautiful rainbow where everyone is diverse. Everyone is, you know, gay or Black or underprivileged or trans. They don't want you to look under the hood. They're hoping the optics take the place of the real change that likely has to happen in the boardrooms and other places. No one's giving up that power. No one. But that's what happens when you open the door to tokenism, because now it'll look very diverse and it's going to be much, much harder to make the same arguments people are making today about inequality and other issues. And finally, let's talk about facts versus facts. I think this is where we need to get to. And I think we were at this point in the 90s, early 2000s, I think we were capable of having rational discussion. I think it was more possible for people from opposite parties to sit across from each other and hammer out a solution to a difficult problem. And yeah, they didn't always agree with the final outcome, but everyone got a little bit of something and hopefully they moved the ball forward. This is the only way. The thing that makes me less optimistic is I don't think the people we're electing are very smart. In fact, most of them are very dumb and opportunistic. How can you be surprised? Think about what you have to go through to get elected to public office. You have to go dialing for dollars, knocking on doors of all kinds of rich people and corporations and who, God knows what else, to get money from them so you can run a campaign. You don't think that process is going to compromise whoever it is that goes into this? And the kind of person who's okay doing that, is that the kind of person you trust, you know, reaching compromise on complicated issues? Of course not. It's not a job that pays enough, certainly not enough to deal with the bullshit and the attacks and the viciousness and the social media hounding and cancellations and people digging up dirt on you and doxing you and coming to your house, threatening you. Who would do this? What kind of mutant monster sociopath would run for office? Even if the accusers, the underpowered, underprivileged people are able to calm themselves, use data, come with rational proposals, I'm not sure that the people sitting on the other side of the table, certainly on the political side, are even capable of implementing them. And their loyalties are divided. They are not responsible to you. They're responsible to the people who funded their campaigns. The people that are the accused. the perpetrators or the alleged perpetrators. I'm not trying to push a particular point or ideology. But what I'm hoping to do here is to get people to recognize what to expect from the nature of our conversations right now. Anyway, I didn't want to start with something so heavy, but here we are. And let's keep going. It will get lighter. Like now, bumper stickers are car tattoos. I saw a car the other day with a whole bunch of bumper stickers. I need to understand, what is the upside? Who are you trying to impress? The driver behind you? And what if they disagree with you? Does that give them some sort of incentive to ram your car or to key it when you're not looking and you park in the lot? What are you doing? What is the point? Now, tattoos, you know, it used to be much easier to make fun of tattoos, but now every girl who grew up, summering in the Hamptons has a little, you know, star behind her neck, you know, one of those non-committal tattoos that you can't really see. It's ultimately a retail purchase, and it's very hard to define yourself or your personality by a retail purchase. Anything you can get to the mall cannot be core to your existence or that meaning. I can understand if someone died young, like a close relative or a friend, or you went to war together, or you were on a pirate ship and you conquered some small vessels on the coast of Somalia. Then I get it. I get the tattoos. But everything else is retail. And it's not that special, unfortunately. I've never felt strongly enough about anything that my opinion might not change in the future with more information or more data. So I never wanted to commit it permanently in ink on my body. And I don't know, a lot of people maybe feel certain I'm not that way. There was an interesting article. When I say interesting to me, and I will make it interesting to you. It's called What the World's Brightest Young People Are Doing About Racial Injustice, the Virus, and Climate Change. And just to start off, I love that young people are working on solutions of all kinds. I admire anyone who gets up and does something and just puts something out there, whatever it is, a solution to something, an idea, whatever it is. Unfortunately, a lot of these business models and ideas aren't that solid and aren't rooted in good strategy. So let's go through a few of these examples. Almost all of them are in their 20s. I don't think they had any that are above 30. Anyway, the pitch for Biteboard is to combat gender and racial bias. They're doing blind testing of engineering candidates, so that way you can't see what they look like, you don't know what age they are, you don't know what, you know, race or gender or anything, which I think is great. I think to the extent you can do it, a lot of hiring should be done that way. And maybe not all hiring, because, you know, realistically, you know, some places you need to look good and, you know, in fashion or whatever. There's industries where this would not make sense. Also, I expect the top 10% of any group in any field to be as good as any other group, whether it's women or minorities, whatever. So top 10% is top 10%. That's my expectations going into everything. But this type of business could end up doing the exact opposite. You know, if a lot of companies have goals of having a certain percentage of minorities or women or whatever their demographic goals, this type of hiring might not produce it. And I'm just wondering if they're prepared to change their pitch and their business model, or they start to feel pressure to fudge the outcomes if they're not getting the results that they want. That's the challenge when you're trying to sculpt a certain kind of outcome, because there's always that chance where you miss, and sometimes you might miss badly. Another one, Learnabi. They created a social-friendly education app for high-risk students in underserved areas. So their New York City students, which is, I guess, where they trialed it, boast an 86% graduation rate from high school compared to 66% of their peers. You can choose your group in a way that you can always show differential performance. So the numbers themselves don't mean a lot to me. this kind of reminds me of some kids in San Francisco wanted to teach the homeless to code. They wanted them to become programmers. Needless to say, that did not work out very well. The problem is high-risk students have very complicated, multifaceted problems. And I've experienced this firsthand, by the way. I've been a volunteer for Junior Achievement in New York City public schools for over 12 years. So I know exactly what the deal is, and I've seen this firsthand. And the problems that these students have are very complicated. They have problems at home. They have other, you know, maybe behavioral challenges. And some of them don't even have access to broadband or devices. So when you are coming up with an app to solve such a complicated problem, I don't think the magnitude of the solution is up to the challenge. I think it's sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You can't solve these existential challenges all the way at the top when you haven't eaten, when you're not safe, when there are family problems. Those are the things that need to be addressed first before you can start saying, hey, we're going to help you learn from this education app. Next, MindRight helps youth of color heal from trauma. Mental health experts are available via text 365 days a year. There are so many assumptions in this startup that it really concerns me. First of all, you have very complicated issues that people might have. And yes, it feels good to be able to reach out to someone who understands and hopefully can help you. I'm not convinced that text is the mode of communication that will help in a lot of these cases, or the level of engagement that is meaningful and deep enough to help. Second of all, trauma is not limited by race. And yes, there may be high correlations, you know, just like there's a higher correlation of blacks who are poor, for example. But when you start to associate a race with trauma or victimhood, that concerns me. I think it sends a terrible message that debilitates people. You're saying, hey, society's against you, the world is against you, you need all this extra help. And I don't like when people divide these kinds of things, which are well-meaning and well-intentioned, by race, because it creates stigma. And it creates, in some cases, excuses, and in other cases, debilitation. And I don't know that this is up to the challenge, but I'm not sure that psychology just as a field knows how to deal with this, much less someone young who says, hey, text your trauma problems if you're black to this number. I'm concerned that people have oversimplified and mischaracterized how help needs to be disseminated. The founder here raised $5 million for a wearable smart band that discreetly reminds healthcare workers to scrub their hands. I don't think it's a bad thing. Yes, healthcare workers should remember to scrub their hands, not touch their face, and all these other cleanliness things. But it sort of reminded me of the smart cup. I think it was called Vessel, and it was viciously made fun of by everybody. I think I tweeted something at some point saying, hey, I get my new app. It reminds you to breathe. At some point, you have to trust the professionals, and you have to trust people to be able to do these kinds of basic tasks. And it also reminds me of something Alton Brown. He's a Food Network guy. He always said, never fill your kitchen drawers with unitaskers. All these gadgets that are good for one thing. Oh, this thing, you know, peels eggs. Oh, this thing, you know, peels oranges. This thing, you know, cracks eggs. You know, and it's all these like little tiny devices, and now you have a drawer stuffed with nonsense. His preference is, hey, why don't you learn to use a knife, or learn to use, you know, a bowl, or whatever else is at your disposal that is a multitasker, because it's more versatile. And I think that's the case here. I'm not sure this solves enough of a problem. Let's keep going. I love some of these things. So I'll give you an example. A consortia to find a COVID-19 cure. Harvard virology researchers use gene editing to detect and destroy viruses. Great. Love it. Someone raised $68 million from the National Institutes of Health to scale up CRISPR coronavirus tests. So CRISPR is a way of editing genes. Let's keep going. They really need to point this out. First generation Arab Americans. When I launch my next startup, is someone going to say first generation Ukrainian American? I wonder, and does it matter? Does the solution matter, or does your demographic matter? I don't know. It's a minor point, but it seems to cheapen the actual work that they're doing, because I don't need to know. I'm not gonna buy their product out of sympathy or pity or guilt. I'm gonna buy it because the best damn thing available. This type of language doesn't work for me. I don't know. Does it work for you? Tell me. I'm curious to know. What they've come up with is a refillable aluminum bottles to replace plastic ones, and they've raised $15 million from celebrities like Kevin Hart and Guy Fieri, and they've sold $60 million so far. I think that's great, but these types of businesses, it's very hard to protect an aluminum bottle, okay? There are knockoffs in China right now, identical things. So this really becomes a brand play. And brand plays are very expensive. You have nothing to differentiate you. A perfect example is water. When you walk in and you see this giant Voss bottle that's like 80% plastic, that's branding. You're not buying a $4 bottle of water because it's better. You're buying it to show off because it says something about you. Building that type of company is very expensive. And I can see why it makes sense to go to celebrities, because you need that free endorsement and free publicity from people who normally get media exposure. Otherwise, you'd have to pay for it, and paying for it is not pretty. Anyway, I don't love this business. I think it could be knocked off very easily. A Vancouver-based B Corp. Oh, okay, I'm about to go off. They raised $5 million to sell hats, shirts, and sweaters, but they're gonna plant trees for each thing that you buy. I love planting trees as a part of the solution for decarbonization. It's very green. So I love that idea. What I despise is mixing it with a company, because a company at the end of the day has to be successful. It has to reinvest, it has to be profitable, and the guilt does not last. It just doesn't. So I think you need to be either a charity or a company. And when you try to mix the two, you have divided loyalties and you end up basically lying. This is an article that I wrote a while back called Should Startups Be Charitable? And I made this chart. This is kind of a way to decide whether you should be charitable as a startup. So the two axes are, is it a profitable industry? No or very. And then is the customer the direct beneficiary? This is very important, because if you are building any kind of organization, especially a for-profit business, and you're going to now give away part of the profit, but the customer is not the beneficiary, that puts you in a very weird position, because who are you serving? Who is this built for? And that's not to say you shouldn't be profitable and not donate some of your profits. You should absolutely do that, but you have to run it as a business. And so if it's not a profitable industry and the customer is not the direct beneficiary, you're basically a charity in disguise. Now, if it's not a profitable business and the customer is the beneficiary, so Chipotle tried to do this, and there's some other one, there's another one called Daily Table. I think that's the one that recycled food from Whole Foods and tried to resell it because it was spoiling but still usable. You have to be extremely efficient if it's an unprofitable industry. So you're always going to be walking that fine line between surviving and failing, because the margins are so low, especially with food. I mean, the best supermarkets are barely 2 or maybe 3% profitability. You think a secondhand supermarket is going to do better? And Chipotle ran into a lot of problems too, because they were like, oh, we try to source locally, we try to do all the stuff with our supply chain, and then they poisoned a bunch of people. Not once, not twice, but 3 times. So then they're like, okay, we better tone down this charity thing because we still need to keep this company in business. Then let's say you're in a very profitable business, but your customer's not the beneficiary. That is the thing I hate the most. And Tom's Shoes is a perfect example. So they're like, oh, buy one, give one, right? Same thing with Warby Parker glasses. I guess it makes you feel good if you don't have any critical thinking skills and you're like, oh, I bought these shoes and, you know, a young boy in an underprivileged nation is going to have shoes. Yeah, but you know what underprivileged nations are really good at? Making shoes. They're really good at it. So you are potentially destroying a local industry or competing with it by dumping a bunch of free product that they could actually manufacture on their own because of the feeling or the impression of doing good that you want to leave with people. It is bizarre to me. It is so insanely bizarre. And even just the slightest bit of critical thinking would put these guys out of business. Anyway, they drive me nuts. Now, if you're in a very profitable industry and your customer is the direct beneficiary, I'm intrigued. I'm not necessarily convinced, but I'm intrigued. So Khan Academy is a perfect example. I don't know if you've seen their videos online, but they help kids learn through these video lessons. And they're very good lessons. Even I wanted to bone up on trigonometry because I was helping a kid, and it's really well done. So it's out there. It's possible, but it's very rare. And I don't like it, especially when it falls into this feel-good bullshit category. Let's keep going. Am I a little angry? I don't know. I can't tell. Bioselections with a C. Okay. Okay. These startups, I apparently were out of URLs. And so people have to bastardize the spelling of everything. And by the way, this is coming from a guy whose website is Idea Factory with a K. So, okay. You know, take it with a grain of salt. This Canadian duo, are they crime fighters? The Canadian duo, they fight crimes on ice. And they're really nice about it, eh? This Canadian duo invented technology that transforms unrecyclable plastic into usable, resalable chemicals. They've raised $7 million and their backers include Salesforce's Mark Benioff. So I've done a long thread on recycling. Most recycling is bullshit. Most of the stuff you throw into the recycle bin, it ends up in landfill. So the only stuff that I remember that gets recycled is glass and metal. That's it. And there might be a few other things like computer parts, but those have to be disposed of properly in order for them to be reused. The reason for that is it's super expensive. The economics fall apart really quickly because remember, you can't just count the bottle, or you can't just count the thing you're throwing out. You have to count transportation to the facility. That uses a bunch of fuel. The cleaning process, that uses a bunch of water, and you know, you have to clean the water and energy and all kinds of stuff and electricity that's in the plant. Then you have to remold it and reshape it. So that involves heat and more fuel. Then you put labels on it and do whatever. Then you have to ship it out again to somewhere else and package it. So no one does this math properly. In fact, a lot of people do a lot of self-serving math to convince themselves or to convince investors that this is good. And I'm not saying that's the case here. I'm just saying it's extremely easy to mess up that math. And I think the reason we still collect plastics and cardboard and all this stuff isn't so much because it's going to be recycled. I think it's psychological, first of all, to get us into the habit of doing this, and maybe on some level hopeful that at some point people are going to discover some sort of method that does make it efficient to recycle. And one other wrinkle in this is a lot of our garbage used to go to China. A lot of our garbage used to go to a lot of poor emerging third world type countries where it just ended up in landfills or incinerated or some other, you know, horrible way of disposing of it. And those countries now don't want our garbage. So now we're stuck with trying to use it here domestically. And realistically, the only way to deal with this is to increase the price to recycle. But it might make the products you love and use every day way more expensive. But don't worry, the Voss water will be just fine. They can absorb the cost at $4 or $5 per bottle. There's this guy who I've heard on Joe Rogan's podcast. He raised $30 million to create this net in the middle of the ocean to collect all the garbage that ends up there, which is most of it. Really smart guy. I think he started it when he was like 19 or something. The first iteration of his machine did not work or did not work as expected. So I think he was working on a second variation of it. I wish him luck and I hope it works out. And this is a quote from him. I actually posted this a while back. "I don't think being against something is very productive. I'd much rather build towards a future that I do agree with." This is from a 19-year-old who's building some pretty incredible stuff. There are a bunch of others that I skip. Just in general, I think youthful perspective is important, but also it can be wrapped in naivete. There are a lot of simplistic ideas that fit on a placard, but don't really stand to reason. And I understand these are emotional times, but you can't build a company that way. And unfortunately, critical thinking and systemic thinking and getting from A to B to C, those things are not taught very well in academia. So if you're walking out of school and you have these notions of all of these problems, the problem may not be what you think, and your way of solving it may not be adequate for the magnitude and the depth of the problem. Anyway, I love that they're trying. Maybe it didn't sound that way, but I do hope that that others are inspired to do better, think harder, and hopefully improve on prior generations. There was an interesting post by David Sachs, who's a founder. I forgot the company he founded. I think it was Slack. No, it wasn't Slack. It was I think it was one that was acquired by Microsoft. It'll come to me in a second. Anyway, so he posted a very interesting but unintentionally revealing post called "Your Startup is a Movement." And that's the way a lot of startups behave. Whether they believe it or not is questionable. A good example was the founder of WeWork. If you read the filing, the S-1 filing, when they were going to go public, you would have thought this guy, his name, I think I forgot the number of times, was mentioned like over 100 times, something crazy. And it was all this cultish mumbo jumbo. And I think on some level, he started to believe his own bullshit. He was getting high on his own supply about how, you know, he's, you know, solving for the greater good and, you know, helping society and doing all this stuff. It was insane. But not unusual. Startups do this, you know, either cynically or in some cases they actually believe it, that they're solving a major problem. They are helping the world and they want to convey that especially to employees because these are young people who are going to work really long hours, get paid a lot less than they would have gotten if they went to corporate, and likely leave before any of their shares become real. In fact, you know, more companies are staying private longer. They're outlasting the average tenure of the people they employ. So if your shares don't become valuable in 4 to 6 years, but the average tenure is 2 years, then you're really floating a lie to a bunch of young, impressionable people to keep them there working like dogs with the promise of this great future and this great wealth and this great idea of helping the world without ever really fulfilling on it. Watch the keynote that I put on Idea Factory called "Don't Build a Business, Build a Religion." I go really deep into this and the psychology behind it. An example of how this went horribly wrong. There was an expose at The Verge, which is a technology blog, and they talked to a bunch of disgruntled employees at a luggage startup called Away. So this startup, apparently, you know, it's hard to tell, you know, because these are disgruntled workers. They're also young workers without a lot of experience. So their expectations of work might not be in line with what work actually is, and what companies actually are. And this startup, apparently, aside from treating people poorly, communicating poorly, being harsh with people, all this other stuff, you know, not coddling them, it also made them feel like they're part of some great movement to revolutionize the way people travel and their comfort and well-being. You're selling luggage. You're selling luggage with a USB port. It's got pockets to put stuff in, and it rolls behind you. It's not changing the world. No luggage startup is changing the world. I don't know. I want to laugh. I want to cry. I want to give them a hug. You know, I have a lot of mixed emotions here. If you're young and you're out there and you're trying to make a career, set realistic expectations. These are still companies. They're going to try to make a profit. And you should be dedicated to your work, but don't go insane about it. Because at the end of the day, your family is what matters. Your friends are what matters. Your community is what matters. This, it's a job. And this guy, David, he's got a complicated last name. He is an author, and he also has a startup that was not funded by VCs. He wrote, "When companies pretend to be family, it's also a key undermining tactic of legitimate solidarity amongst workers. While you might feel family-like bonds with your coworkers, doing so with a capitalist corporation, owners, and managers is just delusional," which is what I just said, but he did it succinctly. Okay, Zoom. You got to stop making Zoom recreational. People are all Zoomed out. They're doing it for their jobs. They're constantly on it. It's great as a compromise when you can't be in the office, but recreationally, you're going to throw a Zoom party? I'm going to kill you. I will kill you if you invite me to another Zoom party. I don't want any part of it. If I have to get my own drinks in my own cabinet and go to sleep by myself in my own house, it's not a party, okay? I'm watching something sad on my computer. Now I'm betting people are going to do this with Halloween. They're going to have like Halloween trick-or-treating. Listen, if you're going to do a Halloween trick-or-treating, I will join your Halloween only if you join me for dinner with Dante in the Inferno. Internships. Diane Feinstein posted a tweet for a clerkship that is a free internship. And there's been a lot of controversy about whether you should pay interns or it's okay to not pay interns. And if you don't pay them, then only rich kids can afford to do it. Realistically, only rich kids can afford to do a lot of things. But, you know, I've had the full range. I've had paid, free, and stipend type interns. What's true almost across the board is it's very hard to get employee-like utility out of an intern for a couple of reasons. The duration that they're with you is very short. They're with you for a couple of months, 2, maybe 3 months. In that time, by the time you train them, which is a huge, huge commitment of time, and get them doing things the way that you want them to do it, they're gone. And even the best ones, the best, add 40% of the utility that a entry-level employee would, especially over that short time period. So I think the best model, and you know, people can debate this, is some sort of stipend to cover expenses and transport, things like that. But and also depends on the type of company you are. If you're a smaller company, then you have to make up for whatever you're not able to pay in experience or network or recommendations or other things that are intangible benefits, which is something that I try to do and try to get people placed. To me, stipend is probably the way to go. And no one really talks about it because we live in this dumb all or nothing culture where it's like, this is the righteous answer. Listen, experience is worth something. It's worth money. Just like people pay for school, they can learn a lot at a job, especially, or an internship that challenges them and not just has them fetch coffee like they do in the fashion and media industries. Are you a scope creep? I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but scope creep is something commonly used in consulting, and then I think it just spread to corporate, where you were supposed to work on one thing and then the scope expanded. Clients are notorious for doing this, where they just keep asking for stuff that wasn't in the original proposal that makes people stay overnight and then overbill maybe if it's an hourly thing, or eat the losses because they're trying to please the client and get more work. We are all experiencing scope creep right now. And what made me think of it is there's a website, or I guess I follow their page on Facebook, called Android Authority. I'm such a dork. And they put a post out about the new Karate Kid show. It's called Cobra Kai. I don't know. People say it's good, but the people who say it's good shouldn't be Android Authority because they're the Android Authority. So you're expecting to get this one thing from them and then you get something completely different. That's all of us now. We're all Android Authority and have nothing and want nothing to do with Android. We want to go talk about politics. We want to go talk about all this other stuff. And it's great. It's entertaining, but it's also a distraction because the money and the respect are found in specialization. And you could argue this very podcast is me experiencing scope creep myself. And I'm guilty of it, I admit it. It just, you know, other things are more fun. Sometimes you want, you know, if you're gonna do things voluntarily, you wanna do things that amuse you or entertain you. And hopefully, if you're amused and entertained, others will be too. And we've all drifted into this, you know, where politics and social commentary have become our identities. And that's where distraction, dissent, and all of these bad emotions lie. And so we're not only distracting ourselves from the thing that could further us professionally and give us a better life and a better life for our kids and families and communities, but we're also angry all the time. So we're not moving forward and we're pissed. In general, startups, creative endeavors, and even political movements cannot afford scope creep. When scope exceeds your abilities to execute, things fall down, things topple over because you end up having too many topics, too little focus, and an inability to finish all of these different projects because you're fighting a war on too many fronts. It's why Hitler lost because he had to fight on the Eastern and the Western front. He had to fight the Russians and he had to fight the Americans. So, you know, wait, did I just use Hitler to make a positive point? It's possible, just trust me. But it's very hard to fight a multi-front battle, especially with limited resources. I saw this today. I think it was a New York Times article by Nicholas Kristof, who's usually pretty good. He's like a well-intentioned kind of social commentator. And he used a quote about the U.S. educational system. And some ranking had Uzbekistan above the US. It was total nonsense. The methodology, if you dig underneath the study and how they got it, was total junk. You can't trust these things because a lot of it is self-reported and it's very, the questions are very subjective. I didn't copy the exact question, but it was something like, do you feel that kids in your country have adequate access to good education? something like that. It was so subjective. It's almost a nonsense question. So it's very hard to get good comparatives across countries. It's not saying we shouldn't try. I think we should. But you got to take them with a grain of salt. And a lot of the studies that are out there are BS. I'm going to do a special at some point. It's on my to-do list. I've been compiling a lot of information on science, pseudoscience, and where academia is failing us. And I think it'll be really interesting. Anyway, this is part of it. I tweeted this a while back, and someone else reminded me of this. Our ability to resist porn, social media, and all of these digital temptations, watching Netflix for hours on end, will be a huge evolutionary advantage if we can muster the ability to resist these things, especially men. And the reason I say that is, speaking as a guy, there was never a moment in my life where I felt like I could opt out of the provider model. But also, I found that all of this stuff that's out there is super entertaining and super distracting. So if the world still expects you to be a provider, and there's a whole bunch of cool stuff to play with or delicious things to eat and ways to lay around watching Netflix, it becomes very difficult to resist these things. And, this is why stoicism is making a comeback, because resistance is so important. It's like brushing, reading, exercise, nutrition, all of these things are so difficult that we have to ingrain them in our kids from youth, this resistance. And what's interesting is the tech billionaires know this better than anybody. There was an article in, I don't remember where it was, but talking about Melinda Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, how they limit screen time for their own kids. They don't want their kids using their own products. They know this is poison. This is poison for the mind. They know that you can't get high on your own supply. I think I've used that like 50 times in the last couple episodes. It doesn't matter. It's important. And so they don't let their kids do it. They don't do it. This is something to paralyze us. They want us on these platforms 24/7. Don't give them the satisfaction. Don't give them that kind of power. Because right now they have it. Oh, this was the tweet that reminded me of it. This is Ed Lattimore. He's a former boxer, smart guy too. He tweeted, "The gap between the haves and the have-nots will get much bigger because of the internet. One group will learn, network, influence, and monetize with great speed and reach. The other will get hooked on porn, argue politics, troll, and binge watch every Netflix series they can." Two wise men informing you of what the future holds. Do with that what you wish. So Eric Ries, really smart guy. He's the one who came up with a lot of startup theories and formalized them in a way that people can digest them. He just launched the long-term stock exchange, which is supposed to only feature companies that are investing for the long-term. It's all self-reported, but what companies say and what they do are often very, very different things. And unfortunately, the long-term stock exchange right now doesn't have enough leverage to make them behave that way. So the profit motive will always win, no matter what they put on the forms that they file with long-term stock exchange. It's also becoming very complicated because companies have gotten so huge. There have been so many mergers and acquisitions. They have so many divisions. They're so global. It's virtually impossible to find a company that isn't screwing someone somewhere. Like it could be abroad overseas where they manufacture, could be some plant that no one knows about and there's all kinds of unfair treatment. Who knows? And even the company might not know. It's getting much more complicated. It's a much more complicated world. And I don't know that this thing, which was conceived a decade ago, is built for these times. We'll see. I wish him luck. Okay. The more you know, the less certain you are. Because each data point, if you're truly a thinking, reasoning person, has the potential to change your mind. It's a different piece to the puzzle. Everything I'm saying on this podcast is the best of my knowledge thus far. But things can change. And that's why it's so important to forgive people. And it's so important to encourage people to evolve, to take in new inputs, to be open-minded. But open-minded people are not certain. And you see certainty all around us. You know, scientists would not make good Fox News hosts. They wouldn't, because you have to project certainty. And even a while back, I remember looking at radio. All of the popular radio hosts were conservative. There were no popular or syndicated radio hosts nearly as popular as Rush Limbaugh. And the reason for that is their approach was very black and white, right and wrong, very moralistic. So they were able to attract people who wanted clarity of perspective. And now the left has a lot of that too, just as much certainty about different issues. It's scary on both sides, because once you're certain, you're not listening. And you're certainly not taking in new information. And it's also why youth is so idealistic. We went through those startups. They're ignorant. They don't have a lot of basis to judge risk, for example. That's why you see a lot of head injuries and jumping off of cliffs when you're in your teens or something. Because, hey, you know, this looks like fun, you know, and then you end up in traction. Or you turn up on Girls Gone Wild, which isn't a thing anymore, you know, or I guess porn or whatever else. You're not thinking through all of the consequences of your actions. It's not your fault. You're young. You're going to make a lot of mistakes. But when you are that young and you're preachy and apocalyptic and lecturing adults, I've got a problem with you, because that shows a lack of self-awareness. And it's no wonder old people, you know, grandpa walks around muttering about the good old days. You have accumulated all this wisdom and you see stupid stuff all around you. Now, grandpa could be crazy too. You know, he might be one of the people you unfriended on Facebook. What inspired this was a post by Daniel Pink, where he said, "Do not mistake confidence for competence." I'm not one to ever dance on anyone's grave, especially small businesses or businesses in general. They employ a lot of people. A lot of people depend on them, especially in times like this. So don't mistake what I'm about to do for callousness. But I have a serious problem with prêt à manger, okay? Or as I would call it, fridgy. I wrote a piece years ago in 2012 about prêt à manger. I don't know if you've been to one of these. First of all, it's a British chain that's posing as a French chain with a French name. And then you walk in and you realize a French person would have killed himself if this was the product of his country. Everything is in the fridge. There's no flavors. It's just textures. You buy a sandwich and you bite in. And the only way you can tell bread from salami is by how hard it is to bite through. It is the most atrocious food, and especially when New York was thriving and people were going to all these different places. There's fresh food all around, amazing delis, amazing, you know, pizza places and salad places, all this stuff. And to go to this is a form of self-hatred. The only way I would have gone to prêt à manger is if I was shot and it was the closest place I could scrape with my nails to get to in order to call for help. And maybe if they gave me a sandwich, assuming I didn't bleed to death, I would have had their sandwich. Anyway, I think they're going out of business. I know those people will find better jobs and will be happier, because looking in the eyes of a person who has lost all self-respect that they would buy their drink and their sandwich and their snacks from the same refrigerator, looking into the dead eyes of that zombie could not have been a fulfilling job. So I wish all of their employees luck and good riddance to prêt à manger. Lululemon, which made $900 million in profits selling stretchy pants to women and now men for like $130. First of all, you can't even tell the difference anymore whether someone is going to work, to bed, or for a jog because they're wearing the same stretchy pants. It is ridiculous. And Lululemon was a huge part of that trend. I guess there's a thing called Woke Capital that tweeted this, that Lululemon is decolonizing gender. I don't know what that means. I'm sure there's someone who's super woke who somehow managed to get to this point in the show without vomiting and can explain it to me. But resistance to capitalism from a company that made $900 million selling stretchy pants for $140 or $150, that is a joke. And if people can't see through that, well, this isn't even being charitable. This is just empty, hollow words that mean nothing. This is garbage. Sorry, Lululemon. I didn't buy it. Did I ruin it for you? You suck. Anyway, Rick Moranis showed up. So if you don't know who Rick Moranis is, I'm not surprised. But Rick Moranis was the star of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And he was in Spaceballs and a bunch of other movies in the 80s. And then he disappeared. He, you know, I think he went to raise his kids. I don't know if something happened to his wife. I don't know the full story. Today, he reemerged in a commercial for Mint Mobile, which is a reseller of T-Mobile minutes. Ryan Reynolds is a part owner and investor in the company. Anyway, the show that I'd like to see, maybe just a sketch, Rick Moranis, career coach. And no matter the problem the person comes with, his advice is always the same. Disappear for 30 years, wait for all of your fans and colleagues to become grandparents, and then reemerge standing next to Ryan Reynolds. So just checking in on the pandemic. I don't think I'm even allowed to say the C word without YouTube flagging these videos. So apparently Sweden is now doing better than the other Nordics and the rest of Europe. And Sweden, if you recall, did nothing. They just basically let people die. Not exactly. They just said, look, you know, do what you think is best, you know, just, you know, don't stand too close to each other. But if you do stand too close to each other, all right, that was the extent of their wisdom. And they, for a while, spiked, but now they've plummeted. And I think it's too early to judge the results for a couple of reasons, because I think other countries are still going to have some spikes. So there's still going to be some new numbers coming in. But I think Sweden is going to end up in a better place, even if they had the same numbers as another European country proportionately, they would still be better off because they have achieved herd immunity. And so now they don't need a vaccine, whereas everyone else has to be on pins and needles hoping that they find a vaccine, because now, you know, they have to social distance, work from home, do all this other stuff. And the Swedes are free to do whatever they want, which I think is eating fish from a jar. I had I think it's Swedish, right? Lutenfisk. Oh, man. Ooh, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. That makes Australian Vegemite seem delightful. Someone online asked me, because I posted about the virus, and he was being kind of a smart ass, but he's like, well, how do you virus proof indoors? Because that was one of my bullet points. And my examples were ultraviolet lights indoors, which are shown to kill the virus on surfaces, glass partitions, which a lot of us have seen when we've gone into, you know, DMV, government offices or other places, distance seating and furniture placement, modify the ventilation system so you get fresher air and it doesn't sort of stagnate and people get sick. Also, capacity indicators, like for elevators or for rooms where you could automatically say, hey, you know, don't come into this elevator, don't come into this room, we're at capacity. Installing sanitizers and mask dispensers in all the different buildings, and creating testing offices in large buildings where if someone's feeling sick or they're not sure, or, you know, the company wants everyone to be tested every day or a couple of days, they can go in and do that. So I'm going to end on this one. You guys can go to patreon.com/McFuture, where I'm going to post episode 5.5 for the subscribers when I'm done recording it. And 4.5 is up there now. Thanks for joining. I'm Steve Factor. See you next time on Mistweeted. I'll do another one next week.